to be located inside the nervous system that we are building to embrace all humanity. That nervous system was conceived of, for reasons I have tried to explain, in the course of the Cold War, for a series of essentially political purposes, military and imperialist in character, and yet embodying within them a set of relatively egalitarian or even anarchist ideas. Because we were building a nervous system for the human race, or at least for America, which took for granted that there was no such thing as a linchpin computer, a hierarchy, a capo di tutti capi of the network, or any such thing. We built it for reasons which were generated by a need for centralized political command and control in a way that eliminated centralized command and control. We created a network of peers. And that network of peers, which embodied the principle that computers can talk to one another across this network without having to know anything about one another and without checking with any third party, that network was constructed in a way which might be taken, oddly enough, to amount to the sort of political goal which those of us who made it might have had, like the liberation of all minds and the creation of a network which could proliferate throughout human society on an egalitarian basis, and which could be operated without direct reliance upon political authority of any kind. We did that. It came into existence. As it was being built, and as its physiology, which we have yet to discuss, was being defined, as the methods of its operation were clarified, changes in the underlying structure got easily made because it was so flexible. And what had started out as a network of peers acquired hierarchy. And the nature of the hierarchy that it acquired and the way that that hierarchy came to be embodied in the physiology of the network, in the rules of its operation, created the possibility of the parasite. Created the biological possibility that the network would be inhabited by a creature whose purpose it was to metabolize human attention. By the end of the 20th century, as I tried to show you, the principle of the attention economy had come to be understood. The network was carrying human attention in a way which could be, at least in theory, controlled and monetized. Controlled meant that there were political possibilities, the exercise of the power of the few over the many. And the economic possibilities, which also turn out to be about the power of the few over the many, but in a different way, gave rise to the possibility that human attention itself could be the subject of the commercial relations. No longer were we getting attention in order to convey a product with some advertising. We were using the attention directly as the substance of commerce. When that happened, a technical design based upon the exploitation of that human behavior populating the network became possible. That's where I left things last time, modulo the conversation about whether children have rights, which I surrender. I understand that everybody knows they don't. In 1985, when my job involved, among other things, reading Supreme Court slip opinions, I was reading one day. It was an opinion being written by the Chief Justice of the United States affirming a decision in the Second Circuit by one Ralph Winter, the untidiest, greediest, most bloviating law professor that I knew at Yale. The question involved in the case called Shawl against Martin was whether children, juveniles, could be subjected to preventive detention before trial. Ralph had said they could. Rentschberg liked it. And the Chief Justice, in this slip opinion, I found myself as a young lawyer reading, the slip opinion told me, in Rehnquist's own words, that, quote, children are always in somebody's custody. And I barfed. Really, I mean, I remember retching at my desk, looking at this sentence. Children are always in somebody's custody. And I thought, fuck you. And a year later, I was sitting in Washington writing a dissenting opinion in United States against Salerno, which was holding that pretrial preventive detention for dangerousness could be constitutionally applied to grown-up people in the federal courts, a decision that still makes me wretch when I think about it. And I was, after all, dealing with another Rentschberg opinion, which was based upon the same basic principle. Children are always in somebody's custody. It was easier to get to preventive detention for adults in the United States because we had already decided that it was fine to put children in who were innocent just because they might be troublesome. But don't worry about it. Children don't have a right to read. They don't have any rights that adults can't get in the way of. Children are always in somebody's custody. You proved it to me last week. We're done. So now we can go back to talking about the network. But as you understand, what I'm trying to tell you is that the politics embedded in technology determines the nature of social control for everybody. And we are losing. And this course is about that. And so I just want to say again, if you want to have a free society, you better have free children. Enough about that. So here we are. We started to build this network. I asked you to go back and look at the invisible barbecue again in scare quotes, because I wanted to point out what it felt like then to be writing about that subject this way. In the immediate aftermath of the 1996 Act, in a room full of big domes at Columbia, it was actually in Casa Italiana, but who cares? And what we are talking about is this, how the continent got wired. And what I wanted to say was, well, we could go back and think about how the railroads came to the continent at the time of the Civil War, and what the politics of all of that meant, and what it did to political corruption, and what we are about to do now. And that was, of course, a quarter century ago. But that was what we were doing then, and that's what it felt like to be looking at it if you had grown up inside the movements and with the comrades I had grown up in at that moment when we started for sure making it and enclosing the human race with it. Now, any questions? I mean, maybe this is all obvious now. I've lived so long that I have nothing more to say because everybody knows it. Yes.
I'm just interested in your perspective. Were there any things that you didn't foresee?
Sure, there were lots of things we didn't foresee. We did not foresee the ease with which a technical material in the way the web is designed would change everything. I knew what single-linked lists were. We understood why searching single-linked lists is burdensome. We knew why, therefore, the possibility of a bottleneck in searching the web was built into the data structure of the web. But that doesn't mean I foresaw what Larry and Sergey were going to do. I remember the moment when Jimmy Wales said to me, as Wikipedia was coming into existence, and we were talking about its future, and Jimmy said, and Jimbo said the words that were the ones dearest to my heart, and that, he said, is the moment when the textbook publishers' heads explode. We did not foresee that their heads were going to explode, but that wasn't going to keep the zombies from owning everybody's mind. We did think, as we'll see in 2 weeks, why the free software movement could actually liberate the layer that determined the physiology of the net, and we could protect ourselves against this stuff. Our failure to be right about that, which required us first to change the entire global software industry and then to turn it in the correct political direction, and we only have succeeded because we changed the entire global software industry. We changed the way everything was made. In the end, after Linus had invented Git in a weekend, we changed the way all programmers worked everywhere on Earth. But right? And so in the largest sense, of course, this is a course primarily about the things we didn't foresee. But that was my job. I was the historian. I was the one who took the role among the comrades of being the one who learned all of human history to figure out what was going to happen. So the failures to foresee were primarily mine. But I learned a lot along the way. And now we're here together. Is that an answer?
Yeah.
Okay. More questions? No? This is all just so simple. Okay, well, I mean, I'll take it if it's a gimme. It's not so simple as that, I think. You have been living your lives, after all, as though you weren't in the clutches of the parasite. You still are. You're still using his stuff. I don't know why. You pay 10 times more for it than it's worth. But he's still out there turning you all into, well, people whose lives can be controlled. You expect it in the relationship that you have to technology. Everybody has one. And the one that you have is the one that assumes that it's out of your control. That there's just ways it works and ways it doesn't work and things you have to get used to. The adaptation is all on your side. The nervous system was supposed to be flexible enough to allow every brain on earth to learn whatever it wants, wherever it is, without regard to ability to pay or the whims of government. And instead, the whims of the network became the facts of your life. And it wasn't working for you. Still no questions? Okay, well, I guess that probably means that you think I'm just crazy and you don't have to care. Because if you thought I was telling you the truth, you'd have some questions, wouldn't you? All right, so here's this anatomy. It consists of pipes and switches, in which the fundamental underlying nature of the switches is as I have described it to you by describing IPv4 and the ways in which we get packets from one place to another, and those fundamental rules turn out to be capable of breaking the laws of mathematics as the early theorists of information understood it. And we can do all kinds of things by breaking up any bunch of data into tiny little pieces and scattering them across the width of the net and waiting for them to self-assemble at the other destination. That both determines the flexibility of the network and acts against the ability to free all of its users completely, because if every packet says where it's coming from and where it's going to, then no packet is anonymous in the end. Fundamental design choices about how data is structured or represented determine political outcomes in the long run. They're very small, but they have enormous consequences. That's why I say it isn't quite as simple as the story I'm telling you, not because I'm failing to give you necessary technical detail, but because the long-term consequences of tiny decisions made at the beginning are very important, because it's all path-dependent. And so I'm both trying to walk the path with you and explain what it felt like to be a person walking on that path, who had particular commitments and goals, and however much of a child he may have been, had his own freedom to make the technology he wanted, and was involved with a lot of other people in making the technology we wanted, and our purposes were political, and as has been pointed out, we failed. And so we're all here now. Ready? Next step? Everything rests one step upon another, so this would be the right time to ask the critical questions about that part of the account before I start burying it in other crazy detail. All right, so we have an anatomy. We have laid out some nervous system. We have seen how pipes and switches together create a nervous system capable of wrapping everybody up and carrying all human communications and monitoring them too. I'm not yet really interested in talking about the spies. That's next semester. It is important to understand that all of this was built in the shadow of the military-industrial complex, doing the most frightening thing that human beings have ever tried to do, namely to conduct nuclear war and survive. Yet, all that did was lay out for us some cells. We have shown the anatomy, but we haven't endowed it yet with any physiology. But I have explained how to think about the physiology of the network. The unit of physiological operation of the network is the service. Where service is here defined for us directly in relation to anatomy. You prick a port on a node, some computer somewhere, at one of its ports, maybe an arbitrary port, or a port which has previously been defined for doing something, sending or receiving email, web server, whatever. But a service is, you prick a port somewhere out there in the network, and the port sends something back to you. That's a service. A reciprocal activity within the anatomy of the network, a request and an answer. At the basic anatomical level, that's the service. You indicate a request to a computer somewhere at one of its doors, and something gets handed to you back. That's the completion of a service at the anatomical level. Now the network is operating. Nerve impulses have a meaning. They're coherent. We could take them all apart and see that this is X asking, do I have mail? And this is Y saying, you have mail. And this is X saying, what's the temperature in Pasadena at the moment? And this is Y saying, 74 degrees and 39% relative humidity and wind out of the northwest at 8, right? I mean, whatever it is, services. The network then, as a physiological matter, comes to be this web of nerves, this set of pipes and switches, pulsing with services, asking and answering, call and response. So far, so good? And if you think about it, you can imagine the network in that form. You use services all the time. We could begin to think about your life, in fact, in terms of services. That would be the natural history of your relation to this anatomy, the physiological history of everything that happened, the meals you ate, the water you slurped, all of that stuff, right? And we could think about you in relation to the services you use. The minute we begin to do that, we are thinking like the parasite, aren't we? We're thinking of the human being in terms which naturally relate to the behaviorist understanding of the parasite, because after all, that anatomy, that physiology of services, I ask, you answer, call and response, well, that's made for the parasite. That's just you clicking and swiping. Every request, every answer, stimulus and response, stimulus and response. We can begin to imagine a view of the net, first in which we think of you in relation to the services you use, and then we think of the net itself as watching those services and characterizing them, building up an understanding of the behavior of the human race within that network, based not upon any mind, but only upon the correlation of stimulus and response. The network now has a view of the human mind, and that's its view. It's made of services. It's made of stimulus and response. It's made of the correlation between stimulus and response. The network, if it had a mind, could think about all of everything going on as a matter of the services, the stimulus and the response. And a picture of the human race could begin to emerge from the network on that basis. Questions? It's not that I see incomprehension in the eyes staring back at me. It feels more like not interest. It feels more like so what? Is that right? Is it so what? Is what I am saying not important in any way? Feels inherently trivial? It could. In order to make it not trivial, you'd have to be displacing your view a little bit from the human-centric one, which is commonplace to you. You'd have to begin to think a little bit like the network. And if you do that, pretty soon I'm going to be able to make you think like the parasite with the mind of God. And then you'll have the mind of God. But you will pay for it. Every time a computer, not your computers, because your computers play dumb, but every time a real computer with real software in it receives a request and provides a service, it makes a log entry. We actually do keep logs of the computers that we run, the same way that we keep logs of the ships we sent across the sea. Human beings understand in that sense that memory will be different for things working in the world than it is for human beings. We are aware that our memory is emotionally bonded, that we remember the feelings that we have about things even more intensely than we remember facts, dates, names, places. We're accustomed, in other words, to the idea that memory is human. But the minute we began to build the network as a nervous system for humanity, we began to locate memory in it. Even before the network, of course, the mainframes had memory. They remembered your telephone bill. They remembered your bank balance. They remembered how many trucks had run across the bridge in order to make sure that we fixed it before it falls into the river and all that stuff. In other words, we began living with non-human memory quite a long time ago. And I'm not now talking about the books on our shelves. The books on our shelves wait for people to read them. But the memory we began to endow our silicon brains with didn't wait for people. Its whole job, in fact, was to work faster than people, to remember more, to have it more available, to be capable of finding it more quickly. And that memory doesn't base itself on feeling. That memory bases itself on addresses. If you know the address of something, you can remember it. So we begin to create a world in which services, stimulus and response, and the particular form of machine memory, which has nothing to do with human experience, but it has to do with captured impulses, becomes the way that human beings begin to think about knowing a thing. Years ago, a friend of mine who was a lawyer at a big semiconductor firm was eating lunch with me in his hometown, and he was describing to me, this would have been in 2012, I guess, the fact that his daughter, a seventh grader, had just broken up with her best friend by text message while they were sitting together on the same school bus. And when he told me that story, now half a generation ago, I thought it was an important vignette about life in the 21st century, and I still do. That's the first time that somebody described to me that fact about the relationship between network and memory and feeling beginning to take root in the lives of young people who were just developing a personality. And the personality that they were developing was a personality made possible by the way the network remembers and understands, or I'm using understands too loosely, the way the network signifies as an intermediary between people. Still no questions? That's because you all have broken up with friends and lovers by text message while sitting next to them on a park bench somewhere. It's normal humanness now. It wasn't then, but it is now. Which tells you something about the way that human beings began to adapt to the network, right? Indeed. Do I think that? Well, why wouldn't I think? Do you think that's what happened?
Yeah.
Why?
Because people don't want to.
Which 15th century experience are you calling up to get there? Which literary moment? Isn't it possible that humans are different now? And that you're on the other side of that transition?
No one wants to like tell someone the things that they're faced that they can do without doing so. Like,
you think so? I've been a law professor for almost 40 years. That's one of my greatest pleasures in life.
Not everyone's
delivering to people things they don't want to hear is lawyer's work, pure and simple.
That's why we get paid big bucks.
Well, or sometimes pro bono publico to tell people stuff they don't want to hear. But you understand that what I'm saying is that it might be that being a lawyer is actually different from this. It might be that we don't actually know how to make people a lawyer this way. It might be that we are now experiencing the degradation of being lawyers less well than we used to be because this. Because making things happen in society using words is different once words are intermediated and the parasite is in between. Maybe that's true. Imagine what would happen if you tried to see it that way, even for a little bit, like, say, the space of a 1,000-word essay. That is, after all, the invitation I am offering. It's hard. The sentiment it creates is the one that I described in section zero as the nausea accompanying metamorphosis. We are different now. By the time of your children's children, no one will remember what it was like to be a human being in the middle of the 20th century when I was born. No one. We'll be different. That's happening. The fact that that is happening under self-government by words would be the definition of the phrase law in the Internet society, the name of this course. Yeah. Let's first figure out what it is, and then we can decide what to worry about. I decided what to worry about before it existed, but I'm not proposing that as a good way of operating now. That's autobiography, but it's not legal analysis. Let's begin by just figuring out what it is, and then we'll see what it contains. Is what I am saying about what it is also obscure? Is my description part of the problem?
Like the change itself?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. We built a great big machine and we live inside of it. And this machine keeps track of everything we do and scrapes our behavior into mathematics. A whole new form of mathematics has come into existence that we now call data science, which is basically statistics for dummies, but with very large amounts of numbers. So you don't have to worry about sampling anymore. Everything's a population. If you think about what that did to math, that will probably seem, you know, like a small deal. It just did something to math. So I'm trying to ask, what did it do to being human? What did it do to the human values that we represent? I don't know about the 15th century. Let's take 1597, late in the 16th century. Man's writing a play about middle schoolers falling in love. Do they send? Are they texting?
No, but
letters,
in a sense.
Yes. But to have a letter, there had first to be a meeting, palm to palm. That's when it started. That's always when it starts. And yet, I mean, you're right, of course, the letters miscarried and two teenagers died. Imagine if they'd had texting. It would all have worked out just fine. Right? Right. We're different now. Oh, you think that's what you are? You think you're able to communicate immediately? Okay, good. So what about that?
I think that, for example, if you...
What will they do exactly? Sue you?
Don't respond by...
Yes. What will they do? Sue you? Send the cops? Yes. It's true. Manners have changed. But more than manners has changed, you've acquired an insecurity. You've acquired a question. I am by myself. What if somebody wants me? I've always known the answer to that question. Well, they can fucking wait until I'm ready. But you can't do that. You're absolutely right. I don't carry a phone. Nobody can get me. They can leave a message. What?
It could be like a business reason or...
It could be anything. It could be anything. My time belongs to me. My consciousness belongs to me. I'm not interruptible. Twenty-two years ago, when my father was dying, was exactly in the place where I am now, 45 weeks to live. I said to him, we were on our last vacation in his life, I said, in the 21st century, the single greatest freedom is the ability to disconnect from the net. You just proved why I said that to my dying father. We are different now. Your sense of your relationship to your own time has been altered by the ability to notify. And notification has imposed a human duty of response. You're a service provider now. When poked, you have to answer. Every inquiry has a response. Guess what, my dear man? Who do you think I think you're working for? In the 21st century, there will be two kinds of people. The people who know how to behave, change the behavior of computers, and the people who don't. And the people who don't will be the slaves of those who do. And I don't think that I know for sure that you know how to silence your own notifications. You certainly don't know how to get rid of all the advertisements. Your consciousness is differently organized. And that happened in the space between you and me. Is that responsive?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Are there any questions? We lived in a world in which we said, I want to know, and we sent a question, and we got something back, and we paid no attention to what was in between. We thought it was transparent, made of glass, but it wasn't. That was the most important technological innovation. We came to think of everything as a pipe, and it wasn't a pipe. There were switches in between. And those switches ran software, and the software determined both what actually happened and what we thought happened. The ability to create those mental impressions in a human being through the network, which was the middleman between human beings, is the change. Is that a, am I making myself clear? This is the single most difficult idea in the whole course. That happened. Now, that's not a technical design element, right? That's at the level where we think about software. We don't make software. This is our understanding of the nature of the substance software, not the particular details. I'm going back to TCP in a moment. I'm going to say port 443 this and port 25 that, but this is the central idea. That the representation of all mental activity in this enormous network changes how we understand our own individual mental activity. More profoundly than anything which has happened since we learned to write. As profoundly only as the adoption of articulate spoken language roughly 200,000 years ago. Hence my view that the long durée of human history is divided into four eras. The first very long era, roughly 4 million years wide, in which we do not have articulate complex speech. And human beings communicate directly by body language, by gesture, by dance, by music, by all sorts of things, but not by complex semantics and syntax. Around 200,000 years ago, we don't know exactly where because it doesn't fossilize. Surely before the human race congealed into sapiens, and while it still had many different parts to it, and we had cousins very close and very different and very far away, but sometime in there we began speaking. That's the second era of the human race. Speech made possible forms of interpersonal activity which are profoundly different. Speech allowed teaching, not by example, but by precept. Before that, our technological education is by showing. This is how you nap a flint. After that, we begin to teach complex ideas and processes by language. That changes who we are socially. When we can write, we change again, because written orders allow power to dissipate itself across vast spaces and to ensure itself across time and to monitor the behavior of people. And we lived in that era for about 9,000 years. And now we live in another one. The beginning of the fourth era of the human race. I saw it born. You are living in its childhood. And it is changing what power is. A good question. The answer is the net more than the computer. But neither one nor the other. It begins with the parasite. It begins with a particular way that software organizes the physiology of the network. Other futures were then possible and still are. The technology didn't determine what humanity did. Humanity determined what it did. But what it did was to make the parasite. Like it made nuclear weapons. Right? Einstein's correct. The atom bomb changes everything except the way people think. But that was the beginning of the process. We changed it then. Tell me, first of all, whether human freedom survives. I don't assume it. I've spent my life hoping, working, but I don't assume. You do not yet know the answer to your question because you don't yet know what humanity is becoming. Not because you don't know what technology is becoming. The problem that we have in defining our future is that we are human beings and it's open. Perhaps you should have said what future you wanted and asked me how to get to it. The teacher becomes different. You read what I had to say in Zero. We have become who we are through our ability to teach one another. This is the distinguishing characteristic of humanity. The errors are marked out by changes in how we teach. From example to precept to reading and the literate culture of the academic world to now. The machine becomes the teacher. The first and default teacher from birth to death becomes the machine. You could say, well, that's easy. The fifth era begins when Elon Musk puts his boots on Mars. The interplanetary species and all that bullshit. I don't think so. No. The question of human freedom should be based somewhere that doesn't require electricity at all, right? It would be bad if we wound up with a definition of freedom that assumed that Aristotle couldn't have had any, and there couldn't have been any in Timbuktu, and there was never any in the Inca of Peru, because they didn't have computers. That can't be right. So what is it that is human freedom? Here I'm going to fall back on my old dear friend, now deceased, David Graeber, who in The Dawn of Everything, The New History of the Human Race, which he finished 10 whole days before he died at 59 years old, David said that human freedom consisted primarily in three things in the long history of the human race. It consisted in the ability to leave, the ability to refuse orders, and the ability to create new kinds of social relationships with other people. Those, David said, were what across the last 10,000 years, since the end of the Ice Age, basically was what it was that human freedom was. And our losses of human freedom were the losses of those abilities to walk out, to refuse orders, and to make new social arrangements. I think he's right. If I have to ask what it is that the historian of human freedom over the secular long haul of human history is studying, I think that's what it is. But for me, the centerpiece was the thing that for the last 1,000 years we have been worrying about, the freedom to think. Freedom of thought is, for me, the center of the entirety of it all. I think that's why people walk out, so that they can go and learn something. for the last several thousand years, because we had to move the people to the books instead of the books to people, that's why a lot of wandering got done. The freedom to refuse orders, that's the central thing. Political liberty, we have called it. Civil liberty, we get all of that. We fought against slavery with our lives. Because it was worth killing and dying not to have to take the orders of people who claimed to own us. Again and again and again and again, we did that. And the ability to make new social relationships, the ability to create politically, the ability to figure out new ways of doing things, and then just to start doing them together, that is freedom. And almost nobody in the human race right now has it. But you will. Because to become a lawyer in an advanced society is to recapture that freedom. It's a great privilege for which you are now playing. When you are fully formed, you, and you pretty much alone around the, among the people around you, will just be able to make it up and make it so. Which is why we are both closest to freedom and the furthest away from being able to see just how endangered it is. Is that responsive? Want to follow up? The parasite depended upon that to some extent. It didn't make it happen. Now let me try and show how it did happen. Next week, I'm going to ask you to look at a talk from the winter of 2009 called Freedom in the Cloud, the moment at which this actually started to happen and I was talking about it. And we'll spend a little time thinking about four young men who were in the audience that night and what they did because of what they heard. So let's begin then where I was starting to stop before questions. Machines keep logs. That means that out there in computer memories from the beginning is the history of everything that happened. What do I mean by that? Did you read a newspaper on the web today? Okay. So you said to the newspaper, could I see the homepage, please? That was a service request. The homepage came back to you, and a piece of software called a browser, a really terrible piece of ugly software, which controls you enormously, but you don't think about it because it's just the way you read, like your eyeglasses. The browser said, okay, so there's a bunch of stuff coming here, including a bunch of stuff meant to keep track of you. Little pieces of JavaScript that came along with the pictures and the text, and its job was to remember who you are, and to remember the last thing you did, and to provide the parasite with a link to the last 45 minutes of everything you were doing on the web before you started reading the newspaper, and all of that little bits of code running inside your browser that you don't know is there, is actually governing your relationship to the newspaper. But you don't know that. Because you just looked at the homepage. And yet already 47 things have started to pay attention to you. How many articles have you read this month? Are you inside the paywall or outside the paywall? All of that is going on and you're not thinking about that. You think you're looking at a newspaper. So you click on something. Okay, now there's another service request. You said to the web server at the New York Times or Guardian or wherever it was, can I see this thing now, please? You think of that as a transparent matter. I clicked on the link. They're going to deliver me the link, but that's not certain. Lots of stuff is going to be decided on the server side because you punched. And we don't know yet what that is. If we trust the server, we assume that some of what you get is going to be the article you were looking for. If we don't trust the server, we could think that something is being sent to you that Tsar Vladimir wanted you to have instead of, but never mind. We don't have to worry about that right now. Another service request occurred. Now some more stuff comes back to your browser that you don't know is there. Some more stuff gets thought about. Some more tracking gets done. Some more analysis occurs. Some more information is stored. Think of that as more stuff going into logs. Think of that as the way a weblog actually looks. You never see the weblogs, of course, because the server isn't under your control, and so you don't know what history it's keeping. Date. Request. Refer. Browser type, etc. All of those pieces of information saved about every interaction you have with every web server. When? How long since the last one, therefore? How long till the next one, therefore? It's just arithmetic on dates. What were you looking for in detail? Where did you come from before you made that request? What browser are you using? How is that browser configured? What we call the browser fingerprint. Knowing your device. Oh yeah, I remember that. That's his phone. All of that information stored forever, all the time. You create thousands of those entries a day, and you see none of them, and you don't know what can be made from them. That's why, in that moment in the winter of 2009, I say in that room at NYU, we show people what happens when cars crash and they're not wearing seatbelts, but we never show them the browser log. You know what harm can be done if you speed around in an automobile without wearing a seatbelt because somebody has shown you what it looked like when it didn't work. Like the Israelis dumping cars by the side of the highway where people have died in crashes in order to make everybody drive better. It doesn't work, but it's very thrilling. You don't know what's going on the other side, so you assume that all it is whatever a human being thinks it is. I asked a question, I got an answer. But it's not that at all. The logs, after all, become the history of everybody's behavior. How many logs are there? That will depend upon how many different servers there are creating services for you, and who gets access to those logs. Suppose I said to you, Google is really just a thing for collecting all the logs in the world. Suppose I said to you, being the Chinese Ministry of State Security means getting all the logs in China. Suppose I said to you, power is knowledge, and this is the knowledge out of which power is constructed. All your behavior, all the time, saved forever. You don't know where, you don't know how, you don't understand what can be done with it, you've never read a weblog. But you can sort of imagine why the weblog on my wiki server would be valuable to other people, and I will never, never let them have it, and why the courseware weblog shows exactly what you read and how long you spent on it and what you did next throughout your education at this fine university. And you can't see that log. Imagine if you could. Imagine if just for a moment you could see the log entries applicable only to you from Columbia Courseware. And you realized, somebody knows every minute that I spent and where I went next and what I didn't read. Everybody knows how long I spent on this assignment and on that one. Well, not everybody, just somebody. I don't know the number, the name of the somebody, but there is a somebody because there is a log. Are you different now? Does it change anything? Had you previously thought your education was your own, and now you have discovered it's someone else's? Or is this okay? Is this consistent with what you think of as freedom of thought? I can't make it consistent with what I think of as freedom of thought. I can't imagine what it would mean to stand in this room and talk to you knowing that somebody had surveilled the reading that you did for me. But it's okay with you? Yes, no, maybe? Because you don't know what the motivation is of those other people.
No, it's more, I haven't experienced, like, adverse consequences.
You don't know whether you have.
Yeah, exactly. But
if you knew you had?
I think it'd be much easier if, let's say, the surveillance got me points on my driver's license because I was XYZ doing something, or I don't know, if I had some real consequence.
And do the consequences to anybody else matter at all, or only the ones to you? But if the adverse consequences involved, say, being tortured, so you just don't happen to know anybody whose smartphone led to their being tortured.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. I mean, that's true. We live here. But here is not everywhere. So it's really what's happened to your comrades. And when I said to you, I have comrades who were tortured because they carried an iPhone to a demonstration in Bahrain, I'm talking about actual comrades and actual torture. But it hasn't happened to me. Nonetheless, that doesn't change what it makes me feel. How about you? Hang a second. I wouldn't want to waste a good cross-examination. How about you? Does knowing that that happens all the time, but just not in your neighborhood, change anything? If I say the second richest society on earth is determined to make sure that happens more, does that change anything? I can't tell you whether my dead comrades in China were tortured. Because, as one of my comrades said to me about them, we will never, ever even find their ashes. Does it have to come into your living space? Or can we get ahead of the curve at all? By seeing that it is happening to other human beings whom we could know right now. Oh, I think so too. I just wanted to get there slowly. Go ahead. Tell me, how is it coming into yours? How about just crossing the Canadian border? How about just crossing the Canadian border? And what happens when I don't have one? Of course not. I never enter the United States with any object that anybody could read. A, I don't have a phone. B, I don't have social media. But C, I would never turn up on the U.S. border with anything that anybody could look at. I play the game for real, after all. I'm two hops from Edward Snowden. When I enter the United States, I can't open my own laptop. It's sealed. The only way to open my laptop at the moment that I enter the United States border is to possess a long arbitrary file full of bits I don't possess standing on the border. When I cross the border and I take a taxi cab home, those bits will be waiting for me and everything will be just fine. But on the border, I am not readable. Also on the Chinese border. Is that relevant? I am keeping it out of my house, right? But you're right, it's there. And you don't have to let it into your house either. What would be different if you didn't? What would be different if you came to the United States border and you said, fuck you, I'm not readable? This could happen to a lawyer, never mind the internet for a moment. Let's leave that one alone. In the fall of 2010, I came to the UK border in bloody Heathrow. I was on my way from India, I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. That's right. I'm on my way to India. I'm on my way from India to London. I'm on my way to Paris and then Amsterdam to give a talk in Leiden. And I arrive on the English border, and the border guard says, "What are you doing here?" And I say, "I'm here on business." And they say, "What's your business?" And I say, "I'm meeting with some international philanthropies and some clients." And the border guard says, "What clients?" And I say, "You must be fucking kidding." And the border guard says, "No, you have to tell me." And I say, "No, I don't." And the border guard from the next booth over leans over and she says to me in a very friendly way, "No, you really have to tell him." And I said, "Well, let's think about this for a minute." I said, "You have the power to prevent me from entering the United Kingdom. I hope you don't use it, but you have that power. You have no power on earth to make me tell you who my clients are. That's against my rules. I'm not doing it. You have a decision to make." I mean, I've got a blue passport, and I'm a law professor and all kinds of things. So I assume we can sort of understand why the guy surrenders and says in a bad mood that he's allowing me into the United fucking Kingdom and what's wrong with me. It could easily have gone the other way. I was totally prepared for that. But I'm a lawyer. There are rules. If I have to say fuck you to a government, it's just Tuesday, right? Who do you want to be? Yeah?
What do you mean?
I mean, who do you want to be?
In terms of what?
Do you want to be the person who is on the downside of that or the upside of that? Do you want to be the person who knows how to say fuck you to the government, or do you want to be the person who turns over your social media to cross the border? Which one do you want to be? You can be either. Yes, it does. You're right. I mentioned Mr. Snowden and my friend Julian Assange and many other people. You're quite right. Oh, I agree with you about that, although not all of them. I mean, some of them are not black or not white or not men. But you're right about that. No, you should meet my friend Annie Machen, who's been on the run from the UK government since she bailed on MI5. I mean, I know he was a white man, but you might want to think about a man who went to jail for giving the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. It's not that this is new. It's not that it's fresh. It's not that we're only allowed to be revolutionaries if we're pink. The history of revolution is not only the history of pink people or guys with penises. There's a lot more to it than that. Our resistance is the resistance of the human beings. It's not the resistance of as strong as you think you are about this, because the rules are made in the software. If you're really very good with software, the rules will change. That's what I'm offering. You're quite right, of course, that there is even more to gain for traditionally disempowered people. You're right about that. You want to use this stuff as an equalizer, you should start using it where equalizing is really, really necessary. If I follow Islam and I live in Europe, I need a freedom box. That's my view. If I live in China, I need a freedom box, but if I have one, they will kill me. You should think about how much we want to avoid getting there. And how we will. And whether becoming the sort of people who just turn over our social media on the border is moving us closer or further away from whom we want to be. These are choices. We have them. One more generation, we have them. Dan Geer is right. This is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. You're it. I don't want you to be afraid. But you can see why, if we don't do this right, there's going to be a lot of fear, and people like us are going to be afraid. And if people like us are afraid, then what the fuck does the rest of the human race do? I don't know, I wasn't around.
But the same idea of like, oh, you know, we shouldn't use this because you could be used...
Who said we shouldn't use it?
I'm sure there was someone back there.
Who said we shouldn't use this stuff? Do you think I'm against computers? Or against networks? Or against software? Who said we shouldn't use it? Did I say you would be better off not eating tapeworms? Yes. That's true. That wasn't an anti-technology argument. That was an argument against eating tapeworms. I use a lot of technology, quite a lot. I do things with it that would surprise you. Yet, that doesn't mean we have to surrender to this other stuff. It's a funny argument to me. But let's see how it works. Go ahead and make more of it. I'm sorry?
As a realist, it seems there's no way to get around eating the tapeworm if you want to use fire.
I don't believe you. I live my life.
But you don't have a phone.
How
easy it would be to communicate with people if you had a phone on you at all times? I mean, I get why you...
Yes, of course, but who said that that was what we do with fire? Who said that what we do with it is carry it around all the time, waiting for it to burn our clothes? Is there a smart way to use fire and a dumb way to use fire? Yes. Every engineer of fire, every fireman, every fire suppression officer everywhere knows that there are better and worse ways to use fire. I'm in favor of the good ones. I'm against the bad ones. Do you want to tell me that there's no real distinction between the good ones and the bad ones? That we can't know whether we're using fire well or badly? I think we can. But it would be okay to say, prove it to me, because I'll try. That's what this course is about.
As a follow-up, you could have a phone.
I do, in fact, have a phone.
Cell phone.
Yes, a cell phone. Made in Finland in 2006, using hardware which I know is not corrupted by all the stuff that happened after that. It has no Wi-Fi. It has no Bluetooth. It's just a phone. Mostly, I leave it at home. If I need it, I have it. If other people need me to have it, fuck them. It's simple, right? I have no leash, but I have a phone. Just as I have 40 nodes in my private cloud and no advertising anywhere. It's not that it can't be done. You're right to think that they want you to think it can't be done. In order to have that, you must have all of this. But it isn't true. Would it be okay if you didn't have that easy, but if I want this, I have to have that? Would it be okay for it to be more complicated? Or does that simplicity help you? There's nothing I can do. It's a kind of learned helplessness, right? It relieves an anxiety. If I knew there was something I could do, I might have to do it. Once I become convinced that there's nothing that I can do, resistance is futile. We are the Borg. It gets easier in a weird way, right?
Right. I'm there already.
Where there?
Yeah,
I gathered that you were there. What if I try and make it possible for you to believe the other thing? This is what I'm asking. Would that be unwelcome? If the news arrived on your mat that resistance is not futile, what would happen? You'd have to decide whether to resist or not. Maybe that's too hard. Maybe you'd rather be in the world in which resistance is futile. See, if I'm 83 million people in the Chinese Communist Party trying to run a place of 1.4 billion people, where over the course of the long history of China, there have been centuries in which there was more than one peasant rebellion a day, I would probably want to let the Chinese know that resistance is futile. That would feel right, wouldn't it? That would be the Chinese Communist Party having the mandate of heaven. If everybody knows resistance is futile, the mandate of heaven is strong. That's a lot of human beings to leave in that condition. I don't want to. But I'm benefited by knowing what I can do. I'm benefited by knowing that resistance isn't futile. I'm benefited by knowing that even though I am professionally adverse to the single strongest team in the world, Because there's a presidential finding I will never be allowed to read that says that if I am less than three hops, less than four hops from Edward Snowden, they can do whatever they want. And I am, and they can, and still I can stand them off to some extent. The best team in the world. I know that I can't stand them off completely, but I know that I can make them work hard for it. And therefore I know that at any given moment, whether they are going to do it or not, depends upon whether the hard work would be worth it to them. There is still one analyst within the intelligence community of the United States trying to prove that Edward Snowden and I met face-to-face in New Delhi on a particular November day in 2008. It cannot be proved because it didn't happen. But I do not know how much crockery they're willing to break in order to try and prove this non-existent fact. Even though I know that there is nothing for them to look for, that they cannot prove it because it didn't happen, still I will make it bloody difficult for them to try. And I assume that the boy in Moscow would want me to. If this course got turned into resistance, would you drop?
No.
Why?
It's the same course.
I was trying to be different, and now you're going to force me to be the same. Yes, you're right. That's correct. And you haven't dropped yet, so maybe it's okay. Is resistance too much trouble? I'm getting all the ads for all the stuff I want. Why should I bother? And of course, we're not at the moment worrying about KGB and the MSS and the NSA. Right now, in this half of the course, we're only worried about Google and Facebook and Twitter. You want to believe that resistance is futile there too? It does seem to me that probably people come to the conclusion that resisting Elon Musk is a civic duty, right? But you haven't stopped using it. Like my phone. What would happen if you stopped? Suppose you decided one day a week I'm leaving the phone at home. What would happen then? Just one day a week. Just Mondays I don't carry the smart ass phone. It sits in a drawer. What would happen? Some people would try and get in touch with you on Monday and it wouldn't work and they wouldn't hear from you until Tuesday or Wednesday. That would happen. Would the people you love stop loving you? Would your family break up with you because they couldn't hear from you on Monday? Would your love life dissipate overnight? Nobody would, you know, because you ghosted everybody for 24 hours a week? No, seriously. What would happen?
24 hours.
I think so too. So why don't we try that and then see what happens after the 24 hours? Then we start trying to leave it home 2 days a week. And then we run into something. Something we couldn't do. Something that annoyed us. And so we make a workaround. And now we're 2 days a week plus one workaround. So we go for three. And it turns out that we have pretty soon located the two or three things that are most in our way if we try and change the grip of the parasite. We found the two or three or four things that we need to adjust. And when you have discovered exactly what those are, then we, you and I, have a technical problem. How do we deal with those four things? And so we work it out. And now it turns out that you don't need any more workarounds because you have them all. And 2 days a week could be fine. The phone is in my pocket when I'm going to meet somebody who, like other human beings, has lost the ability to meet people without a phone. Oh my God, what if we're late? Oh my God, what if the taxi crashes? Oh my God, what if we got the wrong restaurant and et cetera, et cetera. So in order to avoid those little meltdowns, I carry a phone when I am going to meet somebody who is going to try and get me by phone. But of course, when I'm going to meet somebody who, like me, doesn't want to do that, why would I bother even then? My consciousness is not in the phone. My consciousness is over here. I know a lot about how to maneuver a silicon brain around, but I don't need to carry one everywhere I go because it's not my mind. What happens if your life becomes like that? Suddenly the leash has no grip anymore. You've slipped it. Would you be happier or less happy? I think so. That was why I put the question mark at the end.
I would be less happy.
Why?
Because I wouldn't have the job that I want to do.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because they're going to require a lot quicker response than...
What if you say, fuck you?
I'm out of a job.
No, you're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. You just have learned how to say fuck you to a partner. The one associate I worked with in the Cravath litigation department who I knew for sure was going to become a partner was the one who never, ever said a civil thing to a partner. Ever. I never heard Rory say anything to a partner which was printable. And he became partner exactly as I knew he would. You think your power rests in your compliance. Human beings have gotten more like that since the epidemic. You're wrong. But this isn't planning your practice, the course where I teach people what to do after you're, quote, out of a job. Because you're a lawyer with a license, you'll never be out of a job unless you're looking for a job. And the whole problem of this law school is that it makes you think that looking for a job is what lawyers do. But never mind that, because this isn't planning your I'm not here teaching professional self-sufficiency. I'm not telling you that everybody here is clever enough to have her own practice and to make her own living and to build her own practice whatever way she wants, and that in the 21st century, being a lawyer on your own is the very best way to be. We're not talking about any of that stuff here. That's children in the law. This course is Law in the Internet Society, and all I'm telling you is that the benefits of compliance in that sense with the parasite are an order of magnitude less than you think they are. Let's measure. Let's actually experiment. Let's find out. People in this law school go to, quote, mandatory meetings all the time. I watch my first years learning every spring about going to the mandatory meetings. And every once in a while I have to say, you know, there's no such fucking thing as a mandatory meeting. How did they do that to you? Mandatory meetings in law school? Really? Really? Show me the ordinance. But everybody is afraid of something. I will be out of a job. We have whole teams of people who spend more time worrying you about what will happen if you're out of a job than teaching you how to practice law. The system works like that now. I'm a hacker. I try and fuck with systems so that they do unexpected things. You could call that also being a lawyer. Not interesting to you, you have no desire. You don't want to be the guy who can just say fuck you to power.
Yeah, I wish I could be, but...
Ah! There it is. Hold that wish. Imagine that people spent their lives working up ways for you to get that wish. Even now. Even in the midst of all of this. Imagine that the ways to get your wish are still there, but they're becoming harder for you to see every minute. Despite the fact that you have more material available on your side, you have better weaponry than anybody who tried to free himself ever had before. Because the network can do that too. I looked up at the left-hand corner of the browser space on one of my boxes earlier this week, and Brave said to me, you know, it said, I have killed off 1,330,497 trackers since you installed me. I have saved you 49 hours of download time by killing those one. Brave is very good at advertising itself. You should use Brave. But I look at that and I think, yeah, that's a lot of dead bugs on the windshield, isn't it? That's your wish. It's being granted, just not for you. But the minute you pick up half a dozen tools and you start to get a little stealthy, then maybe you start feeling your oats and you think, you know what? I could just tell them to fuck off. That's liberation. That's revolution actually happening. John Adams is correct when he writes to Thomas Jefferson, the revolution began as an idea in one man's mind. Or was that Ralph Waldo Emerson? Maybe it was Richard Stallman. See, we're in a tradition of this, right? I'm not the first one. Guys have been standing here saying this thing for 1,000 years. They've been saying freedom of thought. Now, you're right, of course, that a lot of us got killed. It's like voting. It's easier to do for us now because a lot of other people died so we could do it. Freedom of thought. At the end of your lifetime, it will exist or it won't. If you ask Xi Jinping, it shouldn't exist. So you know what you're up against. But that's in China. It hasn't entered your living space yet because you don't live in Xinjiang. And I have lots of friends who used to live in Hong Kong, and it could never happen to them either because Hong Kong wasn't Xinjiang. And now it is. Except there's a lot more network assets in Hong Kong. You can surveil 4.3 million people in Hong Kong a whole lot better than you can surveil 800,000 people in Xinjiang because there's way more network in Hong Kong, right? And my comrades built it. And now their children will have no country to live in. Your wish is really important to me. I want to see it granted. Questions? I mean, we could go one of two ways here. I could go back to talking about TCP. I could talk about services tightly. That will bring us at the end to LenaCon and the antitrust lawsuits against the platforms and all that other stuff, because we will wind up talking about the market for services, right? All those questions and response, they are the digital economy. All of that physiology in the network is the layer upon which all of this money and all of this power is situated. So if we start talking about the ecology of services, we could get all neoliberal and shit and start talking about the market in services. And then we'll notice that the market in services has a fundamental underlying choice of structure. Let's take a service, that's email. As usual, it's really two services, right? The in and the out. Sending and receiving. They work on different protocols. There's different rules about how to interact with computers to send a message and to receive one. I've described that briefly. Different ports, 25 out, 443, or in. I have a mail tool like, again, a fucking browser or some horrible thing like that that I use to read my email. So it issues requests outbound to the post office that says, send me the headers for the mail of X, or send me the messages one after the other for X, and the server obliges. That's email. But when we have defined the services, when we've stated the rules, how do you talk to an SMTP server? Oh, I say hello with one L, and the server says back, hello, and I say, I have mail for so-and-so, and the server says, give it to me, baby, and I say, here it is, and here it is, and here it is, and here it is, and here's a period on a line by itself, and so we know it's a... Those are the rules of how to send an email message. But we don't really know anything about the power located in email until we know more about the structure of the market for those services. So here's a possible structure of the market for services. We have a trillion email servers. Well, okay, let's be really precise. We have a couple of million email servers. And those email servers provide email to a couple of dozen or 100 people each. And so we have a couple of 100 million people receiving email, and they're all getting it from different servers, and the servers are sending it to one another. And if I feel like adding one, I just add it. And I'll call it mail.moglen.us, or better yet, as you remember, I'll call it mail.kgbmail.net. But it doesn't matter, because I'm allowed to stand up an email server. Because I'm a person in the net, I have a computer, I want it to be an email server, I say, poof, you're an email server, and I have added more services to the market. There was no barrier to entry. That would be called a federated service, because the rules of the service allow us to federate computers and to trade services with one another any way we want to, in any geometry we want to. Here's another way. We create one great big email server and everybody's on it. That would be a centralized service. Nothing about the technology of email, nothing about how we send it, nothing about how we receive it, nothing about who's allowed to do it, nothing determines the outcome. Email is by natural a federated service. We built it to have a trillion servers. Anybody can stand up an email server, but nobody does. It has become a centralized service. That means one entity controls all that email. They read it if they feel like it. They keep track of all the traffic. They know who is talking to whom all the time about everything and how big the messages are. Even if they're never reading any of it, they still know way too much, don't they? The market in services, yes, Jane? Oh, I would guess that many people sometimes do. I don't know. It depends on whether everybody thinks it's okay to read the email because you're the NSA and national security is important, or because you're a parent and parents have rights. The hacking of people's email goes on all the time at every level, doesn't it? National means of intelligence, 14-year-old criminals in St. Petersburg, your children wishing to have some secrets, etc. But the structure of the market in services determines the locus of the power, not the rules. It's not how email works, it's how we set it up. Over there are tapeworms, no question about it. What's the easiest way to hack a Gmail account? But that requires you to have a web server already. How about you just make a phone call and pretend to be the person? You clone a phone. Social engineering attacks on email accounts are rather frequent. Two or three of the most powerful people in Washington had their email accounts hacked in the course of the 2016 presidential campaign, as you may recall. I'm not a black hat. I don't actually hack people's email accounts, but if you want your email account hacked, just let me know. Centralized services are weaker than federated services, because if I build one chain link fence and I put all the email behind it, then the guy only needs one pair of wire cutters. If the same 100,000 people are spread across 1,000 email servers, then the guy has to cut 1,000 fences. That's more work. Of course, maybe he has robots that can cut fences. But what if he doesn't? What if he actually has to use skilled people? The skilled people are very, very good. The skilled people on the good teams are excellent. They make almost no mistakes. And they capitalize on almost all mistakes that everybody else makes. Very, very good. But if they have to be deployed retail, a lot of stuff is simply not worth doing. The intelligence services that steal communications, like our National Security Agency, one of the secrets, the sort of open secrets about how they live, is that it has always been a whole lot easier to steal keys than break codes. They have wanted to appear to be omniscient code breakers, but they're not. What they are is excellent corruptors of code makers and excellent stealers of keys. It's just way easier. It used to be that the bunch of guys who stole keys at the National Security Agency were known as tailored access operations, like all other code names. It has varied since then. But tailored access operations, TAO, is the guys who break in and steal the keys. And they're very, very good, as I say. I was talking once upon a time to a comrade of mine who lives right at the edges of the secret world, stands much closer to the line than I ever will. And we were talking about some particular thing, and he says to me, "Well," he says, "you must know more about this than I do," which is secret world talk for "I know more than you do." But it's a nice, modest way. "You must know more about this than I do, but," he said, "a pal of mine over there has said to me, there's nothing we ever tried to get into that we didn't get into sooner or later." And I said, "Yeah, I believe that." I said, "I believe that tailored access operations is perfectly efficient." I said, "But it doesn't scale." "Yes," he said, "but it doesn't scale." If you really want to understand why resistance isn't futile, because you can raise the cost to the anti-resistance forces. I said, "I cannot keep them out of my computers forever. They are the best team in the world. I will make a mistake one day and they will capitalize upon it, and in they'll be. But in the meantime, I can make it as hard as possible. I can make them use TAO. You can't roll Eben. You can't just hack his Google accounts. You can't break into his iCloud. You can't just count upon him to be using Mac OS X and we have the master key. You're going to really have to huff and puff. You're going to have to do it smart. I'm going to make you circle the thing for months looking for a way in. You'll find it eventually, but by God, by the time you're in, I'll have changed it. Because I have a very small attack surface and I control all of it. So if you want to do that work, Mr. NSA, you have to sweat. That doesn't mean they're not going to win, but it means I'm going to win too. Because now it's not a question if we have a machine and our robots will do it and we'll just dump you in the bag with everybody else. Now it's we're going to have to send a specialist, and specialists are rare. And you're going to have to ask yourself and the analysts you're working for, is it really worth it? It's the same thing with the border. If I come to the border with a machine they can read, they'll read it. But if I come to a border with a machine they can't read, then they have to make a decision. They can say three things. They can say, "Well, you can go home, but we're keeping the machine." I say, "Good. Good luck to you. It's a disposable computer. You can have it. I paid $80 for it. It's yours. Just don't try and get to any bits in it because it won't work." They can say, we're going to keep you here until you unlock this computer for us. And I'm going to say, well, I'm a law professor and the New York Times, and never mind, because I can't do it anyway. So we're all just going to sit here a long time. Or they can say, well, go home and we'll get you later. Which I like, because I go home. And later is later. And every day that despotism has to work a little harder is a good day. I will do it wearing any skin you want to put on me. I will do it carrying any identity I have been awarded. Because there is something deeper in me than my identity, which is who I am. And they can't change that. But then, I have walked down the street in the Soviet Union with KGB behind me. I don't know how to teach courage, but I work in a law school. Courage is the single most important thing. I don't know how to teach it. I'm not sure it can be taught, but I know if it can be taught, I can't do it. And yet, I have been watching people learn courage all my life. That's the market for services, I'm sorry. All of those things, they're all valuable. The single most valuable thing of all is tenure. Nothing approaches tenure. Nothing. Haven't what? If I live long enough, it will happen. It would have happened sooner? Yeah, it might. Sure it might. Sure it might. I knew a guy called Huey Newton getting a PhD in the history of consciousness at Santa Cruz, bringing an armed guard with him. I don't know whether guns in classrooms is really a good idea, but if I were Huey Newton, I might have felt it was necessary, even while getting my degree. I watched him graduating with his PhD and getting the hood put on his shoulders at the command. I think it was my mother. You're right. You're absolutely right. That was why in the Donbass in 1998, In 1988, when somebody called me a dirty Jew, it really didn't matter whether it was Ukrainian or Russian they were using. I got it both ways. But I came out. Other people, much more local than I, have not come out since then. It's chance, you're right. The bullet with my name on it could have been there. But that wouldn't have changed anything. Really, it wouldn't have changed anything. Because I know who I am, but it might have changed something for somebody else. Yeah. Okay, so you want to pick a service that cannot be federated.
Yeah, I mean...
What would be a good example?
I don't know, music streaming?
Oh, no. Music streaming is easily federated. Everywhere I go in the world, all my music is available to stream to me anywhere, anytime, from anywhere to anywhere. If you are sitting in my office listening to jazz, it is because it is sitting on a spindle in my apartment and is being streamed to me. Streaming is slow downloading, and what they mean by the streaming service is, we won't let you keep it. That's all they mean. There's nothing else about it. And to be a collector of music was, in my growing up, a really important example of what it meant to be a cultured person. My music collection is way better than Spotify. So no, that wouldn't be a good example. But we referred to a good example earlier in this conversation. Search is hard to federate. Okay? Why is search hard to federate? Just a tiny bit of computer science, so-called. Computer programs often have to deal with bunches of data, which is random in its order. It's just a list, right? There's two basic ways that a computer program can represent a list. We built whole computer languages out of this. I'm not going to subject you to any Lisp, because there would be too many parentheses and your mind would bend. But we can do two things with a list. We can say, go to the first thing in the list, and it will point you to the second thing in the list, and that will point you to the third thing in the list, and so on ad infinitum. That would be called a single linked list. Each item in the list points one direction at some other item in the list. Or we could represent the list so that every pair points backwards as well as forwards. Okay? That would be a double linked list. Because every place where you are looking at an item, you could branch one of two ways outward. That will have a very significant effect on how fast you can search this list. If I wanted to build the data structure for a list as big as the human race, and I wanted to make it quick to search, I would double link. Then I can always do some really clever kinds of computer programming that we call, for example, binary searching, and I can work very quickly to find things in the list because I can run both roads. If I am trying to search a thing in a single linked list, there's only one way I can do it. I can go to the top, and I can follow each link along the way, and when I get to the thing I want, eureka, I have found it. Okay? And anybody would say to you, that's a really crappy way to do it if you want to be able to find things well. Now I need to say to you, the World Wide Web is a single linked list. Every link in the web points in one direction, outward, from the thing you're at to the thing you're pointing to. Nothing points back. Now, this is actually the right way to do it, not for searching, but for the freedom of building. If the web is made of single linked lists, then nothing controls your ability to make a link. You're writing a document in the web, you want to link to something else, you just throw the link there and it works. You don't need any permission from the thing at the other end. It doesn't have to link back. When Tim Berners-Lee built the hypertext protocol daemon, the first one at CERN, and created the World Wide Web, he was creating a hypertext web of single linked lists. And the reason was to provide absolute freedom of linking so the web could grow, and it did. Tim was taking an idea from a forgotten genius, a man who has been lost to history, named Ted Nelson. Ted invented hypertext about 25 years before Tim made the World Wide Web. Ted spent his life building hypertext in a system he called Xanadu, and it was a double-linked list. It isn't the web we got. The web we got was better because it could go like stink, which Xanadu never could. Also, it was made of free software, which we'll come back to, which Ted could never bring himself to. The double linked list is very quick to search. The single linked list is very easy to build. We made it for ease of building, and we created difficulty in searching. So now, when we want to search the web, we need something to crawl all those links and then remember where everything was. We call those spiders, running the web like spiders will. They belong to Google. Search becomes centralized because spidering the web is centralized, because searching is hard and you need a lot of resources to do it, and the resources come together over here, and then poof, we do advertising and there's the parasite. So search is hard to federate. Now, it's not that we couldn't have figured out how to federate search. We would have needed a completely different design of software. Not the data structure. Let's leave that there. Let's make the web easy to build and hard to search, and still let us federate search. Okay? Now what we will need is some pretty fancy software that works for human beings that does searching. Its job is to go out and look for stuff. Let's call it a fish. It swims in the ocean of information. You want something and you make a fish. And you say, fish, go find me what I want. And it goes and it swims in the ocean of information. And then it swims back to you, carrying what you wanted. Suppose you have a really hard problem. Then you make 100,000 fish. Because they're just computer programs. And you send 100,000 fish out into the world and you say, find me what I want. That would have produced federated searching. In 1997, a very bright young man at MIT started to build the fish. Brian Lamacchia, Lamacchia, look him up. We changed the copyright law of the United States so that we could put his twin brother in jail so that he would stop. See you in a week.